understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am absolutely delighted to be joined by the Reverend Dr. Michael Lloyd, Principal of Wycliffe Hall and author of Cafe Theology. He also recently co-authored a brilliant new book with Rachel Atkinson called Image Bearers. Michael, thank you so much for joining us again. We've spoken to you about a plethora of different theological concepts, particularly looking at the problem of evil, for which you've earned the title Dr. Evil.
Hopefully that's
the reason. Yeah. I'd love to talk to you today about a new project that Wycliffe Hall has recently launched, the New Renaissance Project. Would you say a bit about that, Michael?
Well, yes, we've set ourselves the modest ambition of fostering a new renaissance of Christian scholarship and culture. I don't know what we'll do next year, but that's the task for this year. And I think the reason behind that is just the sense that the church is not speaking to society anymore, and society isn't listening, but it's partly listening because the church hasn't spoken to it for generations. We've been talking to ourselves, well, usually shouting at ourselves, and we haven't actually engaged the culture either intellectually or culturally, and no wonder we're irrelevant. And it's all very well to kind of rail against our not being listened to, but actually we've not been making a coherent, intelligent case. I think that Christian scholarship needs to be the best scholarship there is, so that people naturally turn to the church when they want wisdom on the difficult issues facing us, about cloning, about artificial intelligence, about whatever it may be. People are not turning to the church at the moment, but they should be. And if we do our scholarship well enough, that could be the case again. That's where we want to get to. That's what we want to nudge the church towards. Because it's just a kind of case that what is being taught and thought in the universities today is what people will be thinking on the streets in 20, 25 years' time. Wycliffe is part of the University of Oxford. It has an opportunity to input and influence that. And I think, therefore, we're in a particularly good place to contribute to this process. We won't do it all ourselves. We'll let other people join in. And the culture bit of it, because I think that artists shape what people can imagine, and what people can imagine shapes what they can believe. So I think Christian artists and poets and musicians and composers and filmmakers and puppeteers and everything else have a really significant role to play in shaping the culture and making it more amenable to the gospel. So that's why we've set off on this little project.
I mean, you definitely touched on that with that brilliant, your brilliant thing about what you can imagine shapes what people can believe. But you are an academic theologian. Why is it that you're so passionate about the arts? Because I think for some people, they might think that they're kind of opposite spheres of influence. But for you, they very much go hand in hand, don't they?
They do. And I think for a number of reasons, really. One is, of course, what scholars are studying today are very often the creative geniuses of previous generations. So in our music department, people will be studying Bach. In our English department, they'll be studying Shakespeare. These people have shaped their generations, their cultures, and not only that, but they have actually shaped how we can speak. Shakespeare has affected the language that we speak. That shapes what we are able to think. It gives us opportunities of thinking that we wouldn't otherwise had if he hadn't come and given us words, given us ways of thinking, given us ways of speaking. Contemporary artists and composers, musicians, have the potential to do the same thing again in our generation. I think that's hugely important and significant.
So how does our creativity point to God, do you think?
Well, it is a tenet of Judaism and Christianity that human beings are made in the image of God, and God is the creator. Therefore, we are creative. And our creativity is not a surprise because we're made in the image of the creator. I think the very fact that we embroider everything we do, everything we touch, we decorate from the hand axes that, you know, from hundreds of thousands of years ago, which were made more than just for functional reasons. They were made to the carvings of reindeer made out of reindeer antlers. Wherever you go, you find that we do things much more decoratively than we need. We're more than functional. And that, I think, is a pointer to the fact that we are more than self-replicating DNA. There's something more to us. And the image of God doctrine tells us what that more is. We are here to reflect the creativity of God, apart from, as well as other things and dimensions of who we are.
Now, one of the books that you have co-written, Image Bearers, we've talked about this in a previous episode. It's a book that you co-wrote with Rachel Atkinson. And
yes,
in that book, you've got a quote that's quite similar to what you said earlier. That
repetitive, I'm afraid. I've only got a few basic ideas, which I just recycle.
Churn
and regurgitate.
But for Christian artists and writers and composers, they help to make that Christian version of the world believable because, yes, as you said, they address the imagination and what people can imagine, they can believe. Would you say just a little bit more about that? Why is it that we can believe what we can imagine? What is so powerful about the sort of creative storytelling and the creative art in whatever sphere that looks like?
I think one of the reasons why C.S. Lewis is a writer who has so engaged people is that he has helped to make... He's done two things. He's not as great a writer as Shakespeare, but he's done two things that Shakespeare wasn't able to do, I think. One is to make goodness attractive. The figure of Aslan is an extraordinarily attractive character, and even Shakespeare didn't really manage to make goodness attractive. I don't know whether he tried, but and the second thing that Lewis does, which I think is remarkable, is to make other worlds, other depths, other dimensions narratively plausible. So, you know, when Digory go through the pond into a different dimension, when the Pevensey children go through the wardrobe, he makes the fact that there are other dimensions to reality just seem believable, plausible, and you can take that on board. It's easier to believe once he's written that than it was before.
And I mean, we've definitely already touched on this again, but the church in some senses used to be a patron of the arts. They championed artists. You see lots of incredible sort of art within church buildings even. And now it often feels as if the creative arts and the church are sometimes portrayed as sort of two completely opposing perspectives or worldviews, maybe at odds with each other. Why do you think that is? And I guess crucially, how do you think we rectify that that image that they might be opposing and not part of the same worldview?
Yes, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the church, when it was influential, used to be a patron of the arts. Now it's not a patron of the arts and it's not influential. And I'm wondering if those two facts are in some way related. I don't quite know why the church seem to have lost that. Partly it's not as rich an organization as it was. Partly it has slightly retreated into itself, I think. But I think that is one of the ways in which it has stopped speaking to and inspiring our culture and our society, which is why people don't look to us anymore for either significance or new thinking on the issues of the day, or to mark the life events like births and deaths and marriages in the way that it used to. How can that change? I think we just need to take up that role again. I think we need to take beauty very seriously. Interestingly, there's a bit in that book that you very kindly showed as a bit of product placement.
Show it again. There you go.
Yes, thank you. That's the one. Yes. Where I talk about how important art is in the Bible, what a valued thing it is. And I say, and therefore we ought to make our church services and buildings as beautiful as we can. And in the editing process, somebody said, I cut that bit out and said, that's a bit controversial, isn't it? And I said, whatever it is, it shouldn't be. Sorry, it went back in. But the point is, we need to do that. We need to take beauty seriously. We need our words. When they are beautiful, people listen to them and treasure them. Look what happens to Shakespeare. He's taught in every school in the country. The words of the old translation of the Bible, the King James Version of the Bible, have become treasured and taught. Beauty lasts. It helps our thinking. If you're embedded in beauty, it will embed itself into our imaginations, our minds, our thoughts, and our actions. Now, a local church community somewhere may not have a lot of money, may not be able to commission Tracy Emin to do an unmade bed for their sanctuary or whatever it may be. But they can probably do their own unmade bed. But what they can do is to say to a local choir or dance group or amateur dramatics group, come and rehearse in the church for free. Come and do a sketch or a dance or whatever as part of our worship once a year in exchange for it. But just so that the church is seen as a place that supports that and fosters that and delights in that, delights in human creativity, because we believe in that we're made in the image of the Creator. And that is part of the human calling and part of what we are called for and part of what makes us flourish and delight as human beings.
What do you think that looks like for someone who would perhaps say they're not at all creative? I mean, would you say that they actually are creative? They aren't perhaps an artist or a musician, but they do, because they have the image of God in them, they are a creative being.
Everybody can do something that is more than the functional. I remember when I was at university, our Christian Union group, we had the secretary of it was actually studying Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic. And he used to do wonderful Celtic knot work around all the kind of notices and invitations to things. That's fantastic. And now, you know, he probably stole those ideas from 8th century manuscripts. Fine. we can, if we're not particularly good at creativity ourselves, let's enjoy the creativity of those who are. Let's just make sure that we're not baldly functional in everything that we do. Anybody can put flowers in their on their table. That's borrowing the creativity of God. Yes, flowers, says the 18th century poet Christopher Smart, are the poetry of Christ. So write some of the poetry of Christ around your dinner table or your breakfast tray or whatever it may be.
We need to take a short break, but before we get back to the discussion, I want to invite you to take a look at a new unbelievable course. It's called Did It Really Happen? The Birth of Jesus. Perhaps you've been asked questions about the historicity of Jesus, or maybe you have questions of your own. We've made an in-depth course with experts and theologians diving into the historical accuracy and arguments for and against the Jesus birth narratives. You will be guided through all areas of the discussion with N.T. Wright, Emil Ewing, Daryl Bock, and others. Check it out by visiting premierunbelievable.com/courses.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Now, Now, you talked earlier about the church sort of isn't speaking relevantly into the culture anymore. And one of the things that you touch on when you're talking about the new Renaissance Project is this kind of issue that we have got now with relativism, or this idea yes. of my truth and your truth, because in some senses, you know, the objective truth that the church used to project is perhaps not being spoken anymore. I mean, what is the problem with relativism or that idea of my truth and your truth?
I think there's a number of problems with that worldview and that general prevailing assumption. One is that it's inconsistent, it's incoherent, because it claims for itself an absolutism it denies to everything else. It says all truth claims are relative except for this one. And that's incoherent. I had a friend who was at a group where people were being all very relativistic. And he said, well, I hear what you're saying, but I'm afraid, he got exasperated. He said, I hear what you're saying, but I'm afraid relativism just isn't true for me. which is just pointing out the incoherence of it. So philosophically, I think it's incoherent. Secondly, nobody actually believes it in the end, not deep down. Everybody's got a cutoff point. I remember having a conversation with somebody, again, who was being kind of very relativistic. And I thought to myself, I wonder what your cutoff point is. I don't know, but I'll try this one. And I said, so you would say that a patriarchal society is just as valid as one which gives equal opportunities and rights to men and women. And there was a pause and they said, no, I wouldn't. And I said, no, I wouldn't either. But then go figure. The third problem with it is it's divisive, because if it's my truth and your truth, we live in different worlds. Actually, we don't. We live in the same world. But it's a hugely divisive thing. Roger Scruton, the philosopher, said people, once relativism sets in, people cease to share in any conception that they're joined in a common enterprise. I think that's what we found ourselves becoming more and more tribal as a society. And this is why, because we've shut down the sense of a common truth. And lastly, it's appalling for science. Science isn't relativistic. Science doesn't say flat Earth is just as valid as, you know, as the current model. It isn't, and it doesn't believe that, and you can't do science on that basis. Similarly, it's really bad relativism for justice. Nobody who's been falsely accused of something thinks that all narratives are equally valid. They just don't, because they're not. So those are some of the problems, I think.
And so what's the solution then? If that's the issue, if relativism is one of the problems in today's society, what's the solution to that?
Well, I think monotheism, because monotheism has one reality. And that means that we all live in the same reality, and therefore it's much less divisive. If you have one source, then everything has the opportunity of being in harmony with everything else. Now, that's got to be done. Relativism was not there for nothing. It didn't happen for nothing. It happened because people got fed up with people fighting over truth claims. And they thought it's better not to have truth claims, if that's the case. So we've got to be much more tolerant of people with different views than we have been. We've got not to fight about the things that we value and hold close to our hearts. We've got to pay people respect when we disagree with them. That's the only way in which a non-relativistic worldview can be made humane. So that's the challenge, I think.
Well, I think one of the issues where people are very much fighting over those truth claims, as you say, is perhaps where we're seeing culture wars. I mean, what are some of the significant culture wars that we're witnessing today, do you think, Michael?
Well, let me use one as a particular example, because I think it's very relevant to the relativism question. And that's the whole kind of roads must fall movement. The desire to topple statues that were particularly associated with colonialism, with slavery, with those sorts of things. And one of the really interesting things about that is that the Rhodes Must Fall movement, I think in many ways, whether you agree with it or not, it's a really hopeful sign, because it's utterly unrelativistic. It's because people will say, well, you have to remember that these statues, so they were put up in a time when people's perspective was very different and things looked very different, and you mustn't judge them by modern standards. And the Rhodes Must Fall movement is actually saying, no, that's not good enough. Slavery was always wrong. It hasn't become wrong in the 21st century. It was wrong in the 18th century. If you asked any slave at the time what they thought, they would have thought that it was wrong. This is a wonderfully unrelativistic movement. Now, what you do about statues is another matter. But I think this is one of the signs of that people are getting fed up with relativism. They're beginning to realize it doesn't work, that it's not their friend, and that it's a cop-out. And it lets people off the hook when we need not to let ourselves off the hook.
And where does the church feature in all of this? I mean, should it have a voice in the culture wars? Should it take a particular side? Should it be right in the middle? Should it be telling people not to fight about this stuff? Where do you think it should be?
I think it needs to be a voice of a place of reason, a place where reason is once again allowed to operate, a place where people talk rather than fight, a place where arguments are heard rather than dismissed. I think it needs to be a forum where they're important issues. They're not nothing, the culture wars issues. They profoundly affect things that really matter to people. Fine. Then let's hear what the arguments are on each side. Let's be like a court of law where you get both points of view argued as well as they possibly can be, so that you begin to see where the weak points are on both sides and come to something that is more true and bigger than you would otherwise be able to do. That's what I think the role of the church should be. It needs to be a marketplace of ideas, a court of law that interrogates different positions, a place where people subject their own arguments to critique, because we all have insights, we all have blind spots. There's nothing like letting somebody else critique your own work to see where the weak points of that are. Let the critical hands loose on your own views, because if they're true, they'll stand up to it. And if they're not, we need to ditch them. So I think that's what the church needs to be, is a forum for exchange, for critique, and for exploration.
I mean, one of the things that you mentioned is that the church isn't just talking to itself, it's sort of shouting and it's fighting amongst itself. How do we get the church to stop doing that and to engage better with society and culture, do you think, Michael? Just a tiny little question for you there.
A tiny little question. John Stott wrote a book about preaching, which the American title of that was Between Two Worlds. And why he was such a great preacher was because he knew both worlds. He was bilingual. He knew the biblical world. He knew the biblical languages. He knew the biblical culture. He understood that. But he also really studied the modern world. He had a whole group that would meet together, that would read the key books that came out, that would go and see the kind of influential films that were being shown, that really understood the world that we live in and try to serve and try to speak the gospel into. If you don't understand it, if you withdraw from it, you're never going to be able to speak winningly and winsomely into it. And I think we have to do that a whole lot more. We have to listen to the people who disagree with us. I sometimes find with students that they, you know, they'll do a kind of anti-Dawkins rant in their essays. And you look at the footnotes And you see that they haven't actually quoted Richard Dawkins' book. They've quoted one of the books critiquing Richard Dawkins. That's not good enough. We need to pay people the respect of listening to them and feeling the force of their arguments. We need to know the world as it's seen through different eyes, through different perspectives, and in different traditions. We need to understand it if we're going to serve it and speak into it.
So I suppose, in which case, as we're coming to the end of this, I think it's Psalm 137 where it says, how do we sing the songs of Zion while we're in Babylon? How do we sing how do we sing the songs of God while we're in this foreign land, effectively? That idea of the songs of God on one hand and the kind of, I guess, for want of a better word, the secular place of Babylon. How do we, as Christians, sing a better song, tell a better story, speak truth to a relativistic culture that is also fighting within itself, within the culture wars?
First of all, I think the need for that is huge and very widely felt. Okay, it's an old film now, but Educating Rita, they're all in the pub, the jukebox is on in the background, and Rita's mother just says to no one in particular, there've got to be better songs to sing than this. I think that's where our culture is. They want better songs to sing. I think we've got the content of those better songs. I think we've got a story, a narrative, a worldview that gives hope, that's bigger, is a bigger universe. Flannery O'Connor, the novelist, said the Christian novelist lives in a bigger universe. What we've got to do is make it A, beautiful, and B, in such a way that it speaks into the culture and the society that we live in. That's the task. The gospel is fine. The worldview is great. It has actually what our culture is crying out for. But we've got to show that. We've got to demonstrate that. And we've got to do it in a way that reflects by its beauty the Lord that we serve.
Just quickly, one follow-up question. What does that look like practically, do you think? Or does it just look different for every single person in whatever context they're in?
Yes, I think it does look different because we are each of us made in the image of God, and therefore are creative, but we are each of us unique. We're all different self-portraits of God from a different angle, and therefore the form that our creativity takes will be different. And there's umpteen ways that the church can be involved in listening to the world, in fostering and supporting its creativity, in learning the language so that it's bilingual and can translate the biblical world into the thought forms of the modern world. I don't think there's any one particular way, but there's as Gerald Manley Hopkins says, Christ plays in 1,000 places, and we've got to find our own way of playing Christ in a way that people understand and speak the language of.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And if anyone wants to know about the new Renaissance Project, is the best place to go the Wycliffe website?
Wycliffe website. You'll have various things there. So, yeah, just look up, Google Wycliffe Hall and up it will come.
Great. Well, I'll make sure I put the links as well in the podcast today.
That'd
thank
be great.
You so much for joining us, Michael.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.